Hey there, Question Quest listeners. It's Cody and Suzanne.
Hey.
We are sick. There's sickness all around us in Kansas City.
Yeah, we're congested, but I'm feeling better.
I'm feeling a little bit better, too. But that's not really what we're here to talk about, though, I guess. About a month ago, we met up at the Westport Flea Market in Kansas City for a live Question Quest event.
Yeah, we revealed the story behind the statue in the Brookside neighborhood where people have been mysteriously leaving like these small bird statues around the base.
If you were there, you know that it was a really good time. We had a really good turnout and everybody seemed to be in really good spirits.
Yeah, it was really fun. But if you couldn't make it for whatever reason, here you go. It's a bonus episode.
We've actually got some pictures of the statue on our website. Just go to kcur.org/questionquest.
So you can check those out, or you can just sit back, listen, and enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Question Quest from KCUR Studios.
Where we set out to find landmarks.
Oddities.
Legends.
And all the curious things in the Midwest that make you wonder. What's up with that?
I'm Cody Newell.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. Thank you guys so much for being here tonight. Did you clap?
Yeah.
At this live Question Quest event.
So, without further ado, what do you guys say we get into this? All right. Cool.
Okay. So, the idea for this started with my friend Flannery. She's an artist known locally around Kansas City for this nudie calendar that she puts out every year. She illustrates it. And we grew up together, and we were roommates for a long time and good friends. And she's the one that first told me about this weird statue. And it's actually down the street from the house that she grew up in, but she didn't even know about it until more recently herself.
There's a statue at like 52nd and Brookside. There's like off the trail, there's a statue, but it's covered in gifted birds, like porcelain birds, plastic birds. She sometimes has, right now she has a lei on, she'll have a crown of flowers. Right now she also has some kind of yarn art on her wrist or something, and mostly birds though, lots of bird statues.
So even on Google Maps, it's called the Goddess of the Broken Bird Statue. But I like calling her the Bird Lady, and that's kind of how we started to refer.
It's a better name, the Bird Lady.
Yeah.
Simpler.
So I decided that the best way to go about this was to start looking into the history of the area. And then I also had some people on the ground start, like, spying on the statue over time.
Pulling some private eye shit.
Yeah. And that was that all started back in the summer, and we're gonna get to that in a minute. But first, let's back up and do some history of this area. I called the Parks Department, and there's a historian there, and she turned me on to these articles that were really interesting. So it turns out that statue wasn't always there. It was actually a fountain before that. And it was this fountain. The dolphin and the boy.
A boy and his dolphin.
And it was given to the Neighborhood Association in 1928 by Jesse Clyde Nichols.
J.C.
And Nichols bought this fountain on a trip to Venice, and he gave it to the Countryside Homes Association. And it was just kind of another example of the beautification that he was doing in that area at the time, you know, that gives Mission Hills and Brookside that signature look that it still has today.
You can't do anything in this town without J.C. Nichols being involved.
It comes up all the time when really we do does. Any type of history thing. But yeah, flash forward a little bit. By the 1930s, you know, Nichols had developed the area into neighborhoods, and he had built the Country Club Plaza, which, you know, was growing in success. And all of those neighborhoods south of Brush Creek were growing in prosperity. And there was also the Country Club trolley line, which ran down what is now Brookside Boulevard. And you can also see here, which is kind of fun, this old footage from the 50s, where it's going down what's now Waldo, you know, over by 75th Street. And
you can actually see some of the tracks that are still left over in that exact area today.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, that those tracks not only moved passengers, they moved freight. But so, yeah, the trolley stopped running in 1957. So at some point before 1962, the fountain was removed. And we know this because of a letter that I found from the historian at the Parks Department. It was written by this guy, Mr. John Guild, who lived in the neighborhood. And in this letter, he's asking the Homes Association to do something to replace the fountain that was once there. And he mentions that it had been pretty badly vandalized, and that's why it was taken out. Okay, so I called the Countryside Homes Association, and they have no record of ever replacing the fountain with the statue.
Which is crazy that they didn't have anything at all. Like, all we had to go off of was this letter at first. It's like crazy that they wouldn't have any sort of, you know, somebody would have marked it down, you would have thought.
You would have thought that. That they also suggested that I talk to someone who lived in the neighborhood for a long time. I talked to Carol Duncan, and she actually lived in J.C. Nichols' old house on 52nd Street from 1962 to 2002, about. And she seems to remember that it was the transit authority that put it in.
It was placed there by the railway or the transit to beautify that area. Instead of making it a just kind of a blah corner for people standing and waiting for the bus.
So Carol's 87 now, and she even admits her memory is a little bit fuzzy about this. But she says that when she first moved into her house in 1961, I think I said 1962 earlier, sorry, it was 1961, the statue was not there. She does recall at some point going to a ceremony commemorating the statue, but she doesn't remember exactly when that was. The first time we talked, she said she thought maybe it was in the early 2000s, but then the second time we talked, she remembered that her mother had been with her, and her mother had passed in 97. So we were trying to kind of narrow down, like, a timeline here. And she actually kept a diary and remembers writing it in her diary, but she wasn't able to find that entry before this episode. So she does recall going to an event that commemorated the statue, but she doesn't remember the statue having any greater significance.
I don't think they thought a great lot about it. They didn't think, oh, well, Daniel Boone walked through here, we'll put a picture of him. There was no rhyme or reason why they chose this statue.
It's just so crazy to me still, that nobody has any record of this.
Well, and so I reached out to the Kansas City Transit Authority, the KCATA, and they couldn't confirm any of this. They do own the property that surrounds that statue, and they maintain it, you know, doing general upkeep, mowing, removing weeds, and things like that. I went back and looked at the design drawings. This was the time when they were developing the trolley track trail, and the trolley trail. And in these drawings, there's no mention of the statue. It's not mentioned there at all. And I thought that this was crazy, because this is from 1998, and that started to mess up my whole timeline, too. But then I talked to Ron Guglielmino. Is he here by any chance? Okay.
Oh,
I was hoping he would come.
Ron,
it's okay.
How dare you?
He told me, he used to be in charge of the Transit Authority at that time. He's since retired. And he said that it's not so strange that they wouldn't have been included in those drawings. But he said he went and visited the statue just like earlier this week to kind of get a sense of it, what I was talking about. And he remembered that it had been there before 1994. But he also didn't know where it came from and also seemed to think that that wasn't the type of thing the Transit Authority would have done. So that's not the best gap of timeline there. Sometime between 1961 and 1994, somebody, maybe the Transit Authority, maybe a Homes Association, put a statue in, but no one has any record of this. And this was driving me crazy for months.
It really was. But then, just this morning, as luck would have it, we got an email from a lady named Margaret Sonnenberg.
That area had become, you know, quite deteriorated, and they were hoping to preserve the area and wanted to work with the neighborhoods and the businesses that were along the route in hopes, I think, possibly of someday, you know, having it become a streetcar again or a trolley car again.
So Margaret told me that the statue was installed either in 1982 or 83, actually as part of a KCATA beautification effort, and the Countryside Homes Association was involved, despite the fact that neither of them could confirm anything about this
thing. And can I just jump in here?
Yeah, go ahead.
How crazy it is to me that through all the formal requests that you do, you know, to different people and different positions through the Transit Authority or this or that, like you go through all the formal things and then someone hears a promo on KCUR and emails us saying, oh, I know where the statue came from the morning of this event. I mean, it's good timing, but it's kind of like...
Perfect timing, literally hours before we got on this stage. Crazy.
I'm not complaining. I'm just saying.
No, it's great. And what Margaret told me actually made a lot of sense about it being part of the trolley track revitalization, because during that time period, the ATA wasn't interested in light rail, interested in streetcar, never got off the ground, obviously, but they really were kind of thinking about those sorts of things again, so it made sense.
Wait, you told me something earlier, too. Where did it actually come from?
Oh, right. It came from Van Loo's Home and Garden. Apparently is where this statue came from. So we know about the origin of this statue itself, but we still had the central question of why are there birds on this thing?
And so I talked to the Transit Authority, the Parks Department, neighbors, the Neighborhood Association, the Shepherd Center, which is right there, and everybody knew that the statue was there. They didn't know where it had come from.
Right.
But
they weren't hanging around Van Loo's when it got bought, apparently.
And they didn't, but they knew that birds were being left there, but they didn't know why. No one had any idea about it. There are a lot of theories, but no one had a solid answer as to why. Which brings me back to my friend Flannery.
I started going twice a week, and I didn't notice a ton of changes, except there'd be these kind of spooky poltergeist things where, like, someone would just sort of move or rearrange the birds, or I would take photos and think that I was seeing a new bird, and someone had... The weirdest thing was that someone would stack the birds or, like, nest the birds so that any bird that was a hollow, I think there might have been ashtrays or planters, would have stacks of other birds inside it, or the birds would be hugging or something. Someone left a paper bag, which feels just lazy. It's not a bird. It's not about a bird. It's a book.
So this is the last day that Flannery went. At this point, what are you thinking, Cody?
I was thinking... One, this seems very odd for Brookside to me, because Brookside is a very, you know, kind of buttoned up, nice place that you know, seems like a lot of people kind of dote over things there, and you don't see this kind of, you know, just random stuff. But also, I kind of thought maybe this was like a pagan thing, or maybe somebody was actually, like, you know, giving some offering to the statue of some sort. I don't know. It was very strange.
And so Flannery, you know, obviously being a person who spent a lot of time taking pictures of the statue, had her own ideas.
Well, my guess is that it's a lot of different people. I think there's a lot of motives. I'd be very surprised if the same person who dumped a bunch of doves was the same person who dumped a bunch of eagles, was the same person who put the pear in there, whatever fruit that was the same person who left this paper bag. And I think one thing I realized is if I caught someone leaving something, I would probably have strong opinions about who it was.
What do you mean?
You know, if it's some teens or something, I'd be like, get away from that statue. But like if it's an old, you know, I have to assume it's just like old women or witches or whatever, you know. And the other thing is I have to assume it happens at night, which makes me think that I should definitely not wander about, because I've never, ever, ever seen anyone leave anything there, which makes me think it's a nocturnal thing, which makes me think they're asking me not to investigate further.
But we did investigate further. So our producer, Sylvia, who is here tonight, where are you, Sylvia? There she is. She also was documenting this wonderful statue for us. And at first she thought it might have been like a tribute to the Virgin Mary because there are some churches nearby. But then the birds kind of seemed a little bit more personal to her.
I imagine that there was some sad story behind it. partly because I think it was actually based on having read about this park or this woods in Overland Park where somebody was putting little gnome doors on the trees, and there was a sad story behind that. So I was wondering if there was a sad story behind this.
What was the sad story behind the gnome doors?
I think it was a woman whose child, or somebody, like a little child that died, and it was in honor of that child and sort of for the mother to, I think, to feel better. I think that's a story.
That's where my mind went, too. I thought it was a shrine or like some type of remembrance for something.
Yeah, I thought for a child, because it's so childlike and sweet, and the little birds are like little chicks, like they've just hatched out of an egg.
So that story that Sylvia was talking about was about a lady who found these gnome doors, and her child had died of brain cancer, actually, and she had nicknamed her child Little Owl, and she left a note on one of the gnome doors saying, you know, this reminded me of my daughter, thank you so much. You know, I called her Little Owl, and so the person who was making the gnome doors actually made a little owl on that door for her. And I don't know, I could certainly see the birds being something like that at this point, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, that's where my, like I said, my mind was. I felt like it was some type of altar or shrine, a remembrance of someone. And it kind of got me thinking, as this was going on for such a long time, you know, it's like, how far do I really need to go to catch somebody in the act of leaving, like, maybe something really significant or something, engaging in a really spiritual, personal act? You know, like, do I need to install 24-hour cameras to, like, catch this person doing this? It just felt kind of like, I don't know, not necessary. And
pushing it a little too far.
I started to get really comfortable with the mystery of it all, and just kind of thinking, why can't I just appreciate this and, you know, let it be what it is? And even though Cody and I are in the business of destroying mysteries, I still really like mysteries. And it's kind of like that idea, if you have a really awesome spot that you go to get away from the world, the last thing you're going to do is broadcast that spot to everyone, because you're going to ruin it, and like it loses all of its specialness, I guess. So with all that in mind, I came up with an idea to leave my own bird statue. I made origami paper cranes out of foil, and then I made some out of paper too, and I dipped them in wax to waterproof them. And then my plan was to go and hang them on the statue, and hopefully that whoever was doing this would be moved to get in touch with me, and I wrote messages on them to try to, you know, convince whoever was doing this to get in touch.
By far not the craziest thing we've done for one of these quests. But even though we did that, we still had Sylvia out on the scene, and she was still trying to find out more about the birds.
Well, I went for a run that morning, and that was just before daylight savings, so it was, like, not that early, but still totally dark out. And so, and I had my phone on me, so it was just cool to take the pictures in the dark, and I thought they looked cool. So I posted. I didn't think that somebody was going to say what it was, although I guess I thought maybe I would get some more tips or something like that, or other people would be like, yeah, what is that? Or like, have you ever noticed the birds? But so yeah, I took a picture and then I posted it because I was thinking of you, Suzanne. Oh.
And then I just ruined it.
I don't, can you guys all read that? I'm loving the suspense right now because people can't read it. No one can read it? Oh, it's a geocache. So, this is Beckett Graham. And Beckett's also here. You guys might also know her. She has her own podcast, History Chicks. You should check it out.
Yeah.
And Beckett and her son Jet are the ones who ruined, or I guess you could say solved, our big mystery. Yes, it is a geocache.
Yeah, this it's called Put a Bird on It, and in order to claim it, claiming means you know, have found it or whatever, usually you just open the box, find the logbook. If it's big enough, you add something and take something. This one is very little, but in order to claim it, you have to leave a bird, and it doesn't specify, but you have to leave a bird at the statue to claim it.
Definitely a sweet Portlandia reference going on with this thing.
When Beckett claimed the geocache with her son, it was about 3 years ago, it was their 100th geocache, and it was actually Mother's Day, and it was a pretty memorable experience for the two of them, and they took a picture of it.
Yeah, I remember exactly, and then we thought it was kind of fun, because we even wondered at the time, we're like, you know, if you're not a geocacher, and non-geocachers are called muggles of the geocaching world, so if muggles came across this, my son said, what are they going to think this is?
As a muggle, I fell into that category. And I guess a muggle is a Harry Potter reference. It's what wizards refer to as non-magical people that live among them. So, yeah, we have the answer. It's a geocache. And even when I heard that answer, I thought, oh, it's a geocache. But then the more I thought about it, I realized I don't really know what a geocache is.
So let's talk about geocaches for a second. So I also had no idea what a geocache was. I thought it had something to do with collecting minerals or like mapping geological features of, like, you know, like mountains or something.
Which would be cool.
Yeah, I mean, hey, if people do that, that's totally awesome. But to get a better idea of what geocaching was, I contacted this guy, Chris Ronan, who works for the largest geocaching list service in the world.
The game started in May of 2000. There was a guy named Dave Ulmer who lived in Oregon, and he was a GPS aficionado.
So that is Dave Ulmer. And before the year 2000, you have to realize that GPS in the United States basically was garbage. There was a thing in place called selective availability that the government had put in place because they were afraid that if people got GPS coordinates, they'd be able to pull off, like, terrorist attacks. But I guess by the year 2000, they felt that they had enough safeguards in place to be able to lift that. And it basically changed a lot of things for people like Dave Ulmer, who were way into GPS. And Bill Clinton actually signed the order that took selective availability down.
And overnight, GPS devices went from being accurate to a couple hundred feet to being accurate to more like 15 to 30 feet.
Wow.
And so there were people that were talking about this on those old bulletin boards that were on the internet, those discussion groups. And there was this guy in Oregon, Dave Ulmer. He decided, I'm going to hide something, and I'm going to post the coordinates on this discussion group and see if people come and find it.
And they did. A lot of people actually came and found it, and the game pretty much exploded from that point. And so people started setting up these caches just kind of all over the place that you could find with a GPS, and nowadays you can use your smartphone to do it. And what people do is they hide these caches. Usually it has some trinkets in it. It also has a logbook, and people just go around finding these things, signing their name in it. And if you have one that has trinkets, you kind of take one, leave one kind of thing. And these things come in all different shapes and sizes. I mean, there are some that are really subtle, like the tree branch one. There's, like, sometimes there'll be a fake bolt on, like, metal structures, and that'll be a geocache. It's just kind of insane. And nowadays, there are 3 million geocaches throughout the world on every single continent, and there's even one on the International Space Station. That guy is holding it as he floats. And by the way, Chris Ronan, the geocaching guy, he's actually from Kansas City. He lived in Lenexa, and he got hooked on geocaching while he was here, and he told me that he has found some truly bizarre things.
I went to Brazil earlier this summer, back in June, to find a cache about 3 hours outside of Sao Paulo that was placed as part of a promotion with the Planet of the Apes movie back in 2001. And so it's kind of a rare cache because it's the only one left that's still active that was placed as part of that promotion. And so I'm quite certain I never would have done that if not for geocaching.
All to find a geocache theme to Tim Burton's remake of Planet of the Apes. That is amazing.
Well, amazing is one word. That's probably one of the nicer words that I use to describe.
So I actually asked Chris if he had seen the Bird Lady statue, and strangely enough, he had.
I found that cache in, I think it was February of 2014, And I remember, I distinctly remember finding it in the morning and just being like, gosh, this is a wild statue here with all these figurines around. Kind of one of those quintessential geocaching experiences. I never would have seen that statue and seen those birds, all those figurines, if it wasn't for that cache.
So Chris is pretty into geocaching, I mean, enough to like go work for geocaching.com, but he is not even close to some of the people out there who are truly obsessed with this, especially for the top geocacher in Kansas, a lady named Margie Hunter, who goes by the geocaching handle Hockabee.
I don't keep track of them, but it keeps track of them on the caching page, and I know I have over 70,000, but who's counting?
After you hit 70,000, it's just all the same thing.
I haven't worried about that for so long. I know I'm the number one cacher in Kansas, and that's all I care about. Every once in a while, somebody will say, oh, you're number whatever, whatever in the world. And I thought, okay.
So Margie started in 2007, so she has been geocaching for 9 years. So if you divide 70,000 by 9, you get 7,800 caches per year. If you make a daily average of that, that means she gets 21 caches per day. That is crazy. It's even more crazy because she doesn't do that many geocaches in Kansas City anymore. She travels and does these all over the place. So most of the geocaches she's getting are in different countries, different cities. But so I asked Margie also if she had found Put a Bird on It, and she had. And she actually wasn't that surprised that it stayed under wraps for this long.
You don't want other people to see it who don't understand, because they just pick it up and they think it's cool and they take it home with them, you know?
Right.
So you just kind of keep them in the dark.
Sure.
But a lot of them are placed where, I mean, after you do it for a while, you just know where the cache will be.
And so I tracked down this listing, even though this cache isn't active anymore. It's been archived on the website, so you can't actually even find it on the geocaching app. And both Margie and Chris said that they're not surprised that a geocache could still be alive after it had been archived. Apparently that happens sometimes. So we decided that we were going to go out to this statue and see it.
See if we could find the cache. And we're going to bring the origami birds as an offering. Yeah, this happened a couple weeks ago. We went to the statue, brought the origami birds.
And we actually found the remnants of the cache. But we're not going to ruin that for you guys, because there is a little bit of geocaching etiquette that we have to respect.
Yes. You're supposed to leave no trace. There's this whole cache in, trash out thing that once you go and find a geocache to pick up litter. And really the whole point of it is to not ruin the adventure for others. So, yeah, if you want to get into geocaching, you can go try to find it. But I think it's important for people to know about the etiquette and to respect people's mysteries.
All right. You can go find it.
But there's still some mysteries here.
Right.
Because I still stand by that not everybody who's leaving birds there are doing it because it's a geocache.
Right.
And I still stand by that there is someone or some people who are doing things to keep it looking nice, like doing things like raking up leaves and
right.
keeping it, you know, so it doesn't get out of control.
Well, and the KCATA told us they only mow like a couple times a year, so they're probably not the ones that are taking care of this.
They confirmed for me that they're definitely not the ones doing anything with that.
And more birds obviously keep showing up, as we showed. I mean, people keep putting these things around this statue, even if, you know, they might not know about geocaching. And Chris, the geocaching guy again, he thinks that there could have been this kind of bird thing going on before there was even a geocache there in the first place.
I had just assumed that people had already been putting figurines there, and that then somebody placed a geocache at that location. So I don't know, maybe it's a chicken and the egg thing. I don't know if the geocache was first or if people were already putting figurines there beforehand.
We also went as far to try to find the person who started the geocache, and I reached out to him, but I never heard back from him. And so I kind of did a little digging, looked on his profile, and it looked like he was doing this kind of as a hobby with maybe some young relatives or maybe his kids, but had kind of fallen out of the geocaching community, hadn't done it for a while, hadn't been on his profile for a while. So it's very strange. And so our answer to all of this wasn't exactly maybe what you were hoping for, Suzanne. I don't know.
Well, I thought the oh that the audience made when I said it's a geocache is kind of like...
Probably.
It's not that I wanted it to be something bad or sad or witchy. Maybe I did. I don't know.
it just
felt like such this like deflating, like, oh, it's a geocache. I don't know. But I think Flannery put it best.
I mean, it's still what it is. It's just 2016. The reason there are birds at the statue is because of like a game that people play online, you know? I mean, if it was 1666, there'd be birds at the statue to like appease a god or something. So I guess it's better that it's geocaching and not like ancestor worship or something. I don't know, but is it?
So that is our episode.
That's it.
What'd you guys think? So, we're not quite done yet. If you have listened to the podcast, you know that at the end of every episode, we do a little trivia to kind of stump each other. But this time, we're going to try and stump you guys.
There are no prizes?
Yeah, so don't expect that. We all ready to do this? Yeah. All right.
There is only one country that the geocaching officials believe does not have a geocache on it. What country is it? A, North Korea. B, Iran. C, Sri Lanka. D, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Seeing a lot of A's.
A lot of A's.
A couple D's. And you can also look at what someone who you think knows.
You can
change it.
It's fine. Cheat.
All right, answer?
It is A.
A.
North Korea. So, next question. Believe it or not, Kansas has the longest active geocache in the world. It was placed shortly after Dave Ulmer's geocache in Oregon in May of 2000. In what city is this geocache? Is it A, Lawrence, B, Topeka, C, Salina, or D, Colby?
No one knows this one. They're
saying
a lot of different things.
I'm seeing some C's. I'm seeing some A's.
I'd say it's all split pretty evenly between all the letters.
Yeah, it really is. So, the answer is D, Colby.
Cody's dad got it right.
Yeah, dad. So, a little bit of bird trivia. Which of the following birds has the longest wingspan in the world, coming in at 11 feet 6 inches across? Is it A, the Andean condor, B, the bearded vulture, C, the wandering albatross, or D, the golden eagle? All right.
I think the room has ruled out the bearded vulture.
Yeah, the bearded vulture is done. So, the answer is C, the wandering albatross. And as a visual, 11 feet 6 is precisely twice the height of one Cody Newell. So, double me.
It's a big bird.
It's a big bird. It is a huge bird.
Which of these facts are not true about cranes, as in the birds? Cranes can see a fourth primary color. Cranes are a promiscuous species in that they engage in different sexual relationships with different partners depending on the mating season. C, the oldest known crane was a Siberian crane that lived to be 83 years old. Or D, some species of cranes travel up to 500 miles per day while searching for food.
So which one is not true?
Which one is not true?
I'm seeing a mix.
It's a mix?
I see a group of D's.
We've got a group of D's over here. The answer is B. Cranes are monogamous. Did anybody get everything right?
Oh.
Did anybody get them all wrong? My dad.
So that's it. Hope you enjoyed our bonus episode. You can get in touch with us at questionquest@kcur.org. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm @CodyNewell.
Yeah, and special thanks to Matt Hodapp, Mike Russo, Chris Pruitt, Aaron Pelish, and our producers Brianna O'Higgins and Sylvia Maria Gross for making this all happen. And a special thanks to everyone for coming out to the event and to all of you for listening. And thank you, Cody.
Thank you, Suzanne. Until we meet again.
Yes, until...